Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places with your host, Adam Bronstein.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. In this episode, I'm pleased to bring you Phil Knight, a conservationist and wilderness advocate in Bozeman, Montana. And Phil has been at this for quite a while. He's active now with the Montanans for Gallatin Wilderness and is a board member of the Gallatin Yellowstone Wilderness Alliance. This interview was recorded in late summer when I was still experiencing microphone issues. So in this particular episode, my mic is not picking up any signal, but fortunately Phil's was doing fine. So my voice is a little low and muffled. It's being picked up through Phil's mic. So we talk about Phil's guiding in Yellowstone, his recent watching of wolves killing a bison, the accelerated destruction of wild nature, the fallacies of forest health initiatives, promoting forest resiliency, Phil's early years, his activist history, his time with Earth First, his frustrations learning about how the government was managing public lands, the timber wars and locking his neck to a loading machine, Cove Mallard in Idaho, the evolution of activism, what Phil is up to today, his project to climb all the high points in Greater Yellowstone, which he just completed, his hopes for the ecosystem, the insane influx of recreationists on public lands throughout the West over the summer, and the inordinate influence of mountain bikers on forest planning policy. All right, well, I hope you enjoy the conversation. I always like chatting with Phil, and I think you'll get something out of this. So thanks for listening.
It's been a long time coming. I appreciate you joining me on the program today.
Yeah, definitely.
So how's the field work been?
Well, the guiding is pretty interesting these days. There's it's a good time of year to be in Yellowstone. You've got elk bugling. You've got the rutting behavior. And now we've got this huge pack of wolves that we've been seeing pretty much every day in the Lamar Valley. 2 days ago, I watched as these wolves killed a bison, and that's the first time I've ever seen wolves actually make a kill. It's not something people see very often, and it was very exciting to watch them. These five or six wolves were down in the ground. They were doing something, and I watched them get up, and this bison stood up. And clearly they'd been trying to kill it. It was trying to get away, but it wasn't going anywhere. And so they injured it enough to knock it down and then killed it and started feeding on it. And it was pretty intense.
It was still alive when it was being fed on?
Yeah, they were biting chunks out of it as it was still alive. And it was kind of a relief they killed it pretty quick. It was a fairly small one because that can go on for hours sometimes.
Mother Nature is a bitch sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. It isn't a picnic out there.
How long have you been doing this sort of work?
Guiding for almost 21 years now in Yellowstone for various different companies, but, you know, all pretty similar themes.
And what does your tour look like? What are you guys out looking for, and what are your clients, what are they looking for?
It depends. Some just want a nice scenic tour of Yellowstone without having to drive and have someone to explain what they're seeing and take them to the best spots. Others are really looking for a full wildlife experience, so I specialize in those tours. And, you know, usually we're on the northern part of Yellowstone where bulk of the wildlife activity, so there's lots and lots of bison. And the wolves I mentioned have been very active. That isn't always the case.
And you were guiding before the wolf introduction? Reintroduction?
No. They were reintroduced in 1995 and 96, and my guiding really started in around 2000. So there's been wolves there all along as I've been guiding, but, you know, some years they're really hard to see. Even a couple of weeks ago, they were more difficult to see because they've recently moved, and this big pack has 18 pups, so they have them in a fairly visible location, far enough from the road that a lot of people can watch them without disturbing them. So it's pretty ideal.
Do most of these packs stay within the park? So you're going to the Lamar Valley to see these wolves for the most part?
Right.
Are they staying in the park, or are they moving outside the park too?
So far, this pack is staying in Yellowstone. They have no reason to leave. Could change in the winter, but you know, it depends on the pack and where they are. There's other packs that definitely cross the line out of Yellowstone and go all different directions. This one has such ideal habitat. I don't see that they would be leaving the park much, but they could during the winter, as things get a little more loose, they could start crossing the border over toward Cook City, where they can get into trouble because they do get hunted out there. So we're hoping none of them get shot by hunters.
So seeing like a buffalo getting taken out by a pack of wolves, I mean, that's pretty intense. That's something that most people don't ever get to witness in their lifetimes. And you know, so much of that is happening and people aren't watching, even in more remote parts of the park, I'd imagine. So it's really something to have Yellowstone around. And what has been your takeaway from all of your years guiding out here? Like how do you interpret your experience over all these years?
You know, one of the big takeaways is, thank gosh, people set aside all this wild country where these animals can exist. You know, that was really visionary, and including the national forests and other public lands. We just wouldn't have these kind of wildlife experiences without those places. And the animals wouldn't have as secure of a habitat. You know, a lot of these animals nearly went extinct in the wild or in general. And it was partly the result of having enough habitat to restore them. You think about all the bison in Yellowstone or all the elk. That wasn't always true. If you came to the park 100, 120 years ago, you hardly saw any of those animals. We take it kind of for granted, but it's been very hard work on the part of a lot of people to restore those populations. Grizzly bears, it's been a more recent effort. Wolves, it's a more recent program. So, you know, I'm extremely grateful to the people that have the vision and tenacity to take on those programs and stick with it.
Despite all the controversy and just the really nastiness that happens.
Yeah. I mean, it still goes on, and lots of conservative elements don't want wild nature around. They want to control it all and just, you know, not have wild animals that could potentially, you know, compete with us or threaten our existence or whatever. You know, but without some wild nature around, what are we? That's where we came from. That's what we evolved from. It's made us who we are. Most of our existence as humans has been in wild nature, you know, as hunters, warriors, explorers, you know, just living out there. Our modern world we take for granted, and it seems so cut and dried. And, you know, we got our homes and our jobs and our cars and blah, blah, blah. But that's really not where we came from.
And it's not the real world.
No, it isn't.
As much as we want to continue expanding, it's still not the real world. I don't care how big it gets or how dominant it gets, right?
Right. No, it's artificial. And, you know, you hear this argument that humans are part of nature, and we are. But as all this artificial construct, is that part of nature just because we made it? Now, it's not always so cut and dried, because nature finds a way. And, you know, we're sitting here in my backyard. We've got wild nature right here in some form. And, you know, we get mule deer out here. We get all kinds of things. So some parts of nature find a way, but other parts are more vulnerable and need those wild places. And it's up to us. You know, we get to decide. Unfortunately, we become the dominant force on the planet, and we get to decide if things like grizzly bears or wolves are going to exist, or lions or giraffes or, you know, whales or things like that. Do we want those around? Are we going to have the foresight and patience? Because if we don't decide and make a real concerted effort to protect these things, they're not going to be here.
So the push for extraction and exploitation is stronger than it's been in many, many decades right now. It's really difficult to process everything, and the rate at which it's happening and the secrecy is deeply concerning. And there's just such a push for logging, and we just keep encroaching, and I don't know that we've really learned much of anything other than corporate interests are just still so strong.
Yeah, and you know, we came up against that in the 60s and 70s, that started the environmental movement when so many of our natural processes were threatened, you know, burning rivers and birds dying and polluted waterways and, you know, polluted cities and skies. And, you know, the environmental movement didn't come out of nowhere. It was a direct response to destruction of the environment and threats to our health and our well-being. And we made a lot of headway, you know, Earth Day and building up on all that and all the environmental laws that were put into place for good reason and expanded and strengthened and put to good use. You know, we wouldn't have near as much preservation as we have now, as much wild land or wildlife, or you take clean lakes and rivers for granted anymore, because there are a lot of them, but that wouldn't have been true, again, without a lot of effort. And I look at our history of success with the environmental movement and environmental laws coming from the Carter administration and even Nixon and Johnson, and all that has been put on the chopping block by the Trump administration. For what? I mean, what are we getting out of all this? Some cheaper gas? Well, that's driven by global demand. Where's this push coming from? It is a pushback to success with preserving environmental policies and, you know, preserving some of the places we need. But really, it's humans are getting desperate. There's too many of us, and we're all pushing up against each other, and we all want this great standard of living. And so it's, you know, when's enough? When do we have enough? And how much do we sacrifice to continue to uphold and expand our so-called standard of living?
There's definitely a lot of interesting parallels from, like, when the Clean Water and Clean Air Act came about. But this time seems a little different in that, well, specifically with logging, where we have these forest health initiatives.
Right.
So it's being... the destruction is being sold as the right thing to do. And to the untrained eye, it can be difficult to look at a forest and to determine whether something is wrong. You can look at a creek or a lake and say, okay, this is murky or you know, it's got pollutants in it and everything's dying around it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at a forest, it's very difficult for the layperson to be able to assess that.
So uh-huh.
This really concerns me. I know it does you too. And it's just a false narrative being pushed, and I just wish we could have honest conversations about, yes, we do need, you know, we want these logs for this particular purpose. Yes, we recognize the science. You know, it seems all just disingenuous and sneaky, manipulative. I don't know, like, what do you see, how do you see what's happening today? Like, there's the Governor's Council in Montana,
right? Mm-hmm.
And they're pushing for all this logging, and this is traced back to an executive order that Donald Trump signed, I think it's back in January, for forest health, when he made the comments about California needing to rake its forests.
Yeah.
Well, around that time, he signed an executive order to get governors to convene councils to start really logging heavily to restore forest health. So how do you see this forest health push?
Well, logging has been conflated with forest health intentionally. You know, if you log it more and thin it out, it's going to be healthier. How has that worked out over the long run? You can just look back and see, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, 4 or 5% of our old growth forests remain. Those are the healthy forests. You can walk out into an old growth forest. I don't think it's that hard for people to see it if they get into it.
I should have been specific in the thinning.
Right. So
that's what I had in my mind. I didn't uh-huh. articulate that. But when someone sees a thin forest, they don't necessarily know that it's... because there's still some trees there.
Right, right. Sure. And, you know, not all thinning is bad. But if you're just taking out the big, valuable trees and then call it thinning for forest health, is that true? Generally not. It's logging for taking the big trees, because they're valuable. So, you know, if you really want to thin a forest, you take out the small diameter trees, you take out some of the brush, some of the branches, but that doesn't pay anything. Who's going to pay for that? And you also have to maintain that over time. You know, you got to do it periodically. If you look at these you know, vast forests that do still remain in the West, say in the Gallatin Range, how do you go in and thin in any sort of effective manner that's actually going to impact a wildfire? It's not going to happen. You can maybe affect fire behavior in a few small areas, but thinning overall is, you know, for forest health is just, it's been turned into this whole campaign to support, you know, we're supposed to buy the thought that our forests are sick and unhealthy and we need to thin them and log them to bring them back to health. It's a crock. It doesn't work. And it's also destructive because you're bringing in all this machinery and equipment, you're trampling the soils, you're driving out the wildlife, you're creating roads where we don't need any more roads, you're taking out the big trees that are often the healthiest ones. You don't always need a forest to look healthy. Forests have their own cycle. A healthy forest has a lot of dead trees in it. You know, they stand for a long time. Those dead trees are essential to a lot of kinds of wildlife, including the ones that have fallen on the forest floor. I often get the question on my tours through Yellowstone, why don't they pick up all these dead trees on the forest floor? Those are part of the life cycle. You know, there's a lot of animals that depend on those. Your new seedlings depend on having some down trees. So, you know, forest health is really, it's a whole different thing than what is being pushed by the timber industry.
Yeah, who are we to come in and to say, this needs to come out, this needs to come out on behalf of Mother Nature? Like Mother Nature is determining what lives, what dies, what comes next, and she's responding and trying to adapt to a changing climate that we're responsible for.
Right.
So by continuing to intervene, she's not able to go in the direction that she wants, and we just exacerbate these issues even more.
Right. And things are in such flux right now with climate change that it's hard to know what forests are going to look like in the future. And if we do just let forests burn or, you know, remain unmanaged, who knows what they're going to look like. If we do log them and thin them and burn them, we know we're probably going to make a big mess of it. Nature's trying to sort out what's going on with the climate and adapt to it. And it's happening so quickly that everything's kind of in chaos and in flux. We also look at things, people commonly get the misconception that, you know, insects in the forest are destructive and invasive. Things like pine bark beetles, spruce budworms, they're native animals. They're native to the forest. The trees have evolved with them. The forests have evolved with them. I think of spruce budworm outbreak that's killing a lot of Douglas fir. It's kind of like a forest fire in slow motion without all the flames, but it may have similar impacts in that you end up with a bunch of dead trees. Is that a bad thing? No, if you have big enough forests where natural processes like that can play out over time, you got some dead forest here, some live forest over here. You got some area over here that's turning to meadow, some over here where the meadow is being encroached upon by the forest. There is no snapshot that says this is what a forest is supposed to look like. It's always changing.
In a species, like, have the genetics to be able to survive an outbreak, and then those are the ones who would hopefully continue the life cycle, and nature's selecting for those genetics, and that those are the survivors, those are the ones who will repopulate and hopefully become more resilient to that sort of outbreak in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Part of evolution.
Talks a lot about that, but we're interrupting that process by going in there. And I know we can't stop logging, but it just seems like we're going about it the wrong way. How can we still log and provide homes for people?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I know there's ways to do it. You know, a lot of our timber has been coming from Canada. A lot of our lumber, I should say. And, you think, oh, Canada's this vast storehouse of forests where we can just get wood whenever we need to. Well, they got the same problems in Canada they're depleting their old growth forests. They've got fires, they've got insects, they've got the wildland urban interface, you know, all the same problems here. And I don't know where we can necessarily log sustainably. One is to reduce the size of homes. Do we need these massive homes? Well, you know, people with money can buy whatever size home they want or build whatever size home. Is that necessary? We can look at alternative building materials, steel, and, you know, I'm no building expert. We can look at reclaimed lumber. We can look at all kinds of ways to do it differently. But again, I don't claim to be an expert on construction or timber supply, but I know we can't keep going into old growth forests to log them because that's not sustainable. The timber industry has cut itself into a corner by over-harvesting their own lands, cutting all the old growth off of there, and they constantly want more from public lands. If they can't do it on their own land, I'm sorry, then you know, you can't keep coming back to the public trough. They wanted to log this whole section of state land outside of Bozeman last year. Citizens had to raise money to buy the timber rights. But again, that would have been old growth logging in a roadless area. Even though it's state land instead of federal, it's the same thing, the same impact on the land and the wildlife. So where do we, you know, how far do we go till we say we've cut enough? The president wants us to go into the Tongass National Forest, you know, our biggest national forest with a lot of pristine old growth forest and amazing wildlife and coastal habitat. And that's remote country. You know, where's all that? How do you get all that timber to market? What are the impacts? You can look, take a boat up to Alaska sometime, take the Alaska Ferry, and look at what British Columbia looks like from the water. It's just nothing but a patchwork of giant clear cuts. Is that what we want on the Tongass National Forest in Alaska? Once it's gone, it's gone. You don't bring back old growth forest. You just don't.
Yeah, like placing some restraints, like no logging in roadless areas, leaving trees above a certain diameter in place.
Uh-huh.
You know, these are the sort of restraints that we can be doing now, like you said, building smaller homes. You know, maybe if someone wants a bigger home, then there's some sort of offset or a program where they could contribute to. I'm not really up on the carbon offsets. I'm starting to learn about it.
Right.
But, you know, maybe after 2,000 square feet, then every square foot you have to contribute into a fund that does something. I don't know. There's got to be something. But the tragedy is there's so few homes available for people right now, and there just isn't enough supply. And it's like, where are we going to get this? And there's just constant trade-offs. Anyways, we could go on about this for hours.
Yeah.
So, Phil, where did you grow up, and how did you first get connected with the natural world?
I grew up in Connecticut, fairly rural setting, so I was surrounded by woods. There was state land, state forest behind my house, town open space across the road from my house, and spent a lot of time as a kid running around the woods, and it was just a great place to go with a few friends and run around and, you know, check out what we were capable of, scramble up some cliffs, climb some trees, camp out, hike the ridges, see what kind of animals we could find, you know. It was a place we could go where no one's looking over our shoulder all the time telling us what to do. So that was fairly formative for me to be able to go into the woods anytime. My parents pretty much let me run wild out there, and it was awesome. I mean, so that connected me with nature. And then my parents took me hiking quite a bit and camping every summer to the beach. And I always loved going to the ocean and playing in the water. And, you know, that was important for me. We'd go to the lakes and the mountains. And then Boy Scouts got me more engaged in those sort of things where I was actually backpacking and canoe camping and winter camping with a bunch of friends that I'm still in touch with to this day. So, you know, those kind of things were what I built friendships around, and I still see it that way, doing those kind of things in the outdoors.
So you have a long activist career, and it impresses me to hear some of your stories and just your dedication. You're one of the most dedicated conservationists that I've ever come across.
Oh, well, thank you.
And you're well-known in the Bozeman community.
Mm-hmm.
What has your experience been as an activist? And when did you first get into activism? Let's start there. When did you first get into activism? What was really the driving moment for you?
Yeah, that's pretty easy to pin down. I'd moved to Bozeman. It was my first winter here, actually living here. And I'd already spent time in Yellowstone and around in the mountains around here, and was totally amazed by the wild nature that was right at my doorstep. So the winter of 1986, this traveling road show came through Bozeman called the Great Montana Wild West Exposition. And I saw a poster for it and went to it. And it was some of these Earth First activists had put together a road show. And they had live music, they had slideshow, they had speeches. And these people had a lot of passion and really good musicians too. And that struck a chord with me, you know, and I went and talked to them at the end of the show. And they said, oh, you interested in, you know, joining up with us, helping out? I said, yeah. So they called me almost right away. They reached out and I got involved pretty quickly. And the first campaign I got involved with was trying to protect grizzly bears in Yellowstone at a place that was getting overdeveloped, and too many bears were dying there as a result. Too much conflict with people and bears. So our first activist, or our first action, was to go to the park headquarters in Mammoth, and we invaded the superintendent's office with a film crew, and we presented him with the Conservationist of the Year Award, which is a buffalo pie with a Don't Tread on Me flag stuck in it. I got to hand him that, and this was Bob Barbie, the superintendent at the time, and he told me to take my award and shove it, and he got quoted on national television, so that was pretty satisfying.
Uh-huh. Anything come out of that?
Well, that campaign went on for a while, and we were very dug into that one for a few years. Bob and I are friends. I haven't seen him in a while, but when we have communicated, we are friends and respect each other, despite what I did to him there. kind of set him up. But what came out of that was a lot of the development at Fishing Bridge was shut down. The campground was totally removed. That area is no longer a mortality sink for grizzly bears. I don't take, you know, our campaign wasn't totally to credit for that, but we had some influence on it. The Park Service made some bad decisions there and some good ones, and it's kind of settled out. So, but that one got me interested in and involved with grizzly bear conservation. And that was partly because my first backpacking trip in Yellowstone, first one in the West anywhere, I went solo in the backcountry of Yellowstone and ended up seeing two grizzly bears sitting by myself on a ridge watching these spectacular animals cross a valley and thinking, wow, this is incredible. I'll never forget this moment. And, you know, that had a lot of influence on my approach toward grizzlies. And I'm thinking, I owe these animals a debt right now because look what they've done for me. They just inspired me in a huge way.
So when you first went to that road show, and you were just like, yeah, these guys are doing some cool stuff that agrees with you or that resonates with you. What do you think you had found by that time that really set you up to be accepting of that activism and that real need to take action?
I was starting to get frustrated with the government's approach to managing public lands. I was starting to learn a little bit about it. And, you know, as I started to discover national parks and national forests in the West and started to learn a little more about it, it didn't take long to realize it's not all fun and games, that there's some problems out there from mismanagement or overlogging or what have you. And I'd seen it in a few places. You know, I drive up some back road in the Gallatin Range to go hiking and come across this big clear cut of stumps. You think, wait, I thought this was national forest. I thought this was preserved land. And, you know, there's still a conception out there amongst people that national forests are all preserved. And I sort of had that idea when I first stumbled across something like that. And I was just absolutely appalled. You know, it's vandalism. So I wanted to do something about it. And I was young and, you know, full of passion and ready to go. And it's like, here's some other people that feel the same way and are pissed. And, you know, they have some experience. I can learn from them what to do. So, you know, I jumped right into it. I also have long had a mistrust of authority. And, you know, these people were anti-authoritarian, and I was all about that. Let's stick it to the man and all that. Yeah, so, yeah, you know, it was partly...
That issue, too. Always have.
Yeah, it was partly for fun, yeah. To raise some heck. And, you know, instead of just raising hell for hell's sake, you raise hell for a cause. Much more appealing.
Right.
And you can
something
you know
those
be,
underpinnings, because there's always something there. You don't just show up at something like that, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, okay, I'll go along with this. It's like, no, there's a reason why you're kind of bought in by that time.
Oh, totally.
So how did your activism progress down the line? Like, what were some campaigns you were involved with?
Let's see. Well, I got involved in the timber wars pretty early. You know, as I mentioned, seeing what's going on with logging on national forests and being pretty upset about that. And as I dug deeper into it, realizing, you know, there's all these roads being built into roadless places, you know, is the industry driving a lot of that and politicians. And so I got pretty involved with that. Also, you know, I went to Redwood Summer in California, where the big effort there was to try to save some of the old growth redwood forests that were being liquidated to pay off junk bonds, to put it bluntly. And, you know, billionaires buying up forests to pay off their junk bonds to try to stay out of prison. They just liquidate these things. So I went to a place called Murelet Grove, which was a 300-acre redwood forest that was privately owned and being logged. And with a number of other people, we went in there in the middle of the night. I locked my neck with a U-lock to the axle of a big loading machine. And so and several others did similar things. And so when the logging crew, the machine operator showed up, they couldn't run their machines without killing us. Well, we failed on that one because they cut down the entire grove within the next year. So it was symbolic more than anything else. But it still felt like taking a stand, you know. And I don't regret doing those things because I made a lot of good friends in the process and had learning experiences. Here's what you can do. Here's what you can't do. Here's what works. Here's what doesn't work. You know, we're trying to figure it out as we go. So another campaign, the one I always refer back to, is called Cove Mallard. It was in Idaho. I learned about some big timber sales that were underway there. And there's this fellow named Ron Mitchell, who was a real warrior for the forests in Idaho, who recently died. And he was the only one that appealed these big timber sales. And he was trying to stop it when he didn't get any help. And he actually got undercut by some of the big environmental groups that were willing to trade off these roadless areas. So we said, no, we're not going to put up with this. And we called it Two Timber Sales, Too Terrible to Ignore. And started a campaign to stop these huge timber sales in the middle of nowhere, which involved a lot of direct action and also PR campaigns and lawsuits and marches and rallies and everything we could think of, basically.
Didn't some laws come out after that to highly dissuade direct action?
There was some attempts in Idaho to criminalize direct action like that.
I feel like there was a whole spat of laws that came out kind of as a result of that, I know that time period, but maybe even that specific campaign.
That could be. I mean, we had a pretty big impact on the political scene there, and you know, the conservative politicians pushed back. There was slap suits, which are strategic lawsuit against public participation. They were thrown at some of the activists to try to quell their activist tendencies. So $100,000 fines for things like burying yourself in a road in a national forest. And there were, I don't remember the history of the laws that came out of it too much, but I think you're probably right about that. I don't think they've really stood the test of time. You know, most of the actions we were undertaking were nonviolent and proved to be fairly effective. But we stopped about 3/4 of the timber sales there through a long, protracted, drawn-out campaign. And cost the Forest Service $6 million in trying to stop our efforts and ultimately stopped a lot of those timber sales.
Did people show up from all over the country?
They did. They even came from other countries. We had hundreds of people out there at times, and just in the middle of nowhere, Idaho. The locals, most of them turned against us. These little towns called Elk City and Dixie, Idaho. You can guess with a name like that, you know, what their political leanings are. But the first summer out there, they were kind of curious about us, and we were able to talk to people and buy stuff in their little stores. And we even had some meetings with them and dinners and stuff. And somebody got in there that next winter and just spread lies and disinformation and turned us into villains. So nobody would talk to us anymore. So we reached out in the wider area and started having softball games with the Nez Perce tribe and with the Forest Service and doing things like that to try to spread some goodwill. But yeah, it was crazy. We bought a 20-acre parcel, an old mining claim, and made it our base camp so we couldn't get kicked out.
Wait, the
Ancient Forest Bus Brigade.
The group, like your group came together and got some money and bought a parcel of land.
Yeah, one group called the Ancient Forest Bus Brigade. This guy, Robert Amon, known as Ramon, Uncle Ramon, he somehow came up with the money, probably from his own pocket for the most part, and bought this old mining claim. So we put a school bus and a couple trailers on it, and it was our base camp. So,
how long were you guys there for?
6 years.
That camp was there for 6 years?
Yeah.
So it's just a constant rotation of people coming in and out?
Yeah, during the summers. You know, winter, there was nothing going on really, but yeah, there's always people coming through.
That's almost like Extinction Rebellion, but just a whole different context and time. I wonder why we don't see that going on today.
Yeah, it's a good question. Where's the young people, you know, taking a stand? I guess partly it's other issues are coming to the fore. Black Lives Matter, Me Too, things like that. Really important stuff, equally important. It's, you know, climate movement. That's where I think a fair bit of the energy of the youth is going. And, you know, they're serious about it. And I think some of those tactics we were using back in the day maybe are not appropriate now or not going to work. It is more dangerous to do direct action now. You're more likely to face more criminal charges and violence. You look at the Australian Forest Defenders, they went through it years ago and they inspired some of our tactics. And some of them underwent beatings. They had their home. Well, I mean, it happened here too. People had their homes burned down. They're beaten, you know, they're fined, lost all their money, had their families threatened, things like that. In Australia, they had an entire encampment attacked and burned in the middle of the night. So, you know, this stuff comes with consequences. It's not all fun and games. And it's a hard thing for people to undertake as life gets more complicated. I guess my life was pretty simple back then. I could take off for 2 months and live in the woods.
Yeah, it's more difficult for people today, generally speaking, to, you know, everyone's just living paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
And so debt-strapped and just, yeah, it's really hard.
Yeah, a lot of people are just fighting for their own families and survival, and to have time to put into a, you know, years-long direct action campaign or just to stick your neck out in any way is scary. Yeah. I think that's part of it. But still, you know, it's also scary. What are the consequences if we don't take a stand? If we just let industry run wild or let the government just kind of trample on our rights and our, you know, take away our public lands or log the hell out of the Tongass or whatever it is, what are the consequences of that? Which is scarier?
That's an individual choice, I guess. It comes
true
down to it.
Yeah.
How much you want to stick your neck out, what can you afford to do? And also, like, organizing online, too, that has risks because there's surveillance.
Mm.
And, you know, I bet you, not to be a conspiracy theorist, but there's probably been organizations of folks who would want to go out to do direct action. And this is the way people meet each other today. And, you know, if a government agency detects that, they could shut it down before anything ever happens. Even if the full intent is to be peaceful and just disruptive.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure that happens from time to time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, there's ways to go about it. And, you know, you can use online organizing effectively, and there's different ways to do it. And I'm no expert on that, but you know, and there's backlash and consequences, like you say. Look at TikTok, where some of the young activists on there just totally disrupted one of Trump's campaign rallies, and now he's trying to shut down TikTok in this country, and probably will do so. So, but you know, there's a lot of ways to run around on the internet and organize, and there's always another way to get in touch.
Yeah.
So I don't think people should be discouraged from doing that.
Yeah, just find like-minded people and get together and see what you can do to make a difference.
Right. Set up your own networks, your own contacts.
Yeah.
Set up a network of texts you can send each other, whatever it is.
So today, in 2020, you're still involved in activism. That type of activism might have changed a little bit for you, it sounds like. But what motivates you today, and what are you involved with today?
Well, I just finished writing a major objection to the Custer-Gallatin National Forest Plan. That took some effort. It's the last step in the process of influencing the forest plan, other than possibly going to court. So, you know, it's all the same game, from direct action to writing objections. It's all trying to influence management of public lands toward a more positive outcome, as I see it. And I'm motivated by my passion to protect these places that I love, and to make sure at least some wild nature is still going to be around. I'm motivated by the desperate circumstances of our planet, and want to make my own little bit of difference. And in some ways, it's just become a habit. It's what I do day to day, is keep track of what's going on out there, and not just internalize it, but try to externalize it and say, okay, here's something that doesn't make sense, that I'm angry about or upset about, or that I can do to make a difference. And people do, to some extent, look to me now for advice and ideas, and I try to help people out when they're looking for ways to go about protecting the environment.
So as we find ourselves in this truly corporatized and compromised world, as you know, a lot of our environmental groups aren't doing the work that we really expect them to be doing today. And they spread messages of, you know, I'd say that they're leaving out really pertinent facts about what's being given up to have these wins that they can campaign around.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are looking to get involved in the conservation or the wilderness movement are looking to these groups to guide them and to be mentors and to be carrying this torch forward. And it really gets me down to see, you know, what's happened to these groups. What would you say to young people who want to make a difference and who are learning about how some of these groups are operating? What advice would you give them?
Well, by these groups, I guess you mean the bigger sort of corporate environmental groups.
Yeah.
Without naming names, you know, there's some of those on state levels and national levels that certainly are pretty sold out. I'd say look for the grassroots groups, the smaller local groups that have a small budget and are mostly volunteer-driven, or start your own if you don't like what the big ones are doing. It doesn't have to be anything complicated. You know, get a few people together and you can pretty much drive your own agenda. So it is frustrating, and, you know, it's all about the money. You build a group to a certain level, and I think there's this kind of tipping point where you become dependent on money for salaries and rent for your offices and all those things, and you're willing to start compromising to take that money to keep your entity alive. And I understand the trade-offs there. It's difficult. That's why I've tried to stay with small grassroots groups. I do work with the Sierra Club a lot, and that's one group I think that has been fairly good at sticking to their principles. There's always issues with any big national group, but Sierra Club has undergone a lot of self-examination and continues to do so, and acknowledges when they make mistakes and tries to readjust their course. And they're doing that right now. So I have a lot of respect. And they're driven by local grassroots groups too, you know. So look for those kind of groups. And if you're making donations or getting involved with a group, you know, ask where your money's going, and be careful about where you put it.
You just finished a landmark of a trip. You climbers at all the high points in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, in the mountain ranges within the ecosystem. Is that accurate?
That's right.
And when did you start that?
Well, I started it not on purpose, just having fun climbing mountains. In 1982, my first summer here in the Yellowstone area, I climbed some of these peaks because it was the thing to do and it was a lot of fun. And then as I progressed further out into some different ranges, I eventually realized, wow, I've climbed over half of the high points, in the different mountain ranges around Greater Yellowstone. So it's about 10, 12 years ago, it sort of clicked in my head like, oh, I could create my own list and here's an excuse to get out into some mountain ranges I might not ever see. So I made this list of 22 peaks, 22 different ranges, started trying to climb them all. And I just finished climbing the last one this summer down in Wyoming, the Salt River Range, Mount Fitzpatrick. So I was inspired partly by this fellow named Thomas Turiano, who wrote a book called Select Peaks of Greater Yellowstone. Wonderful book. It's out of print, but really fantastic with descriptions and photos and this whole history of mountaineering in the Greater Yellowstone area. So I've actually been in touch with him recently, telling him what I'd accomplished and asking what he's up to. And there's a lot of people more motivated than me out there. So there's 107 peaks in that book. He's on the verge of climbing all of them. I think he has 4 left to do. So those are the kind of people that inspire me too. People that are willing to push it a bit and get out there and, accomplish some exciting goals.
What did you see out there that really struck you?
Well, in some ways, how big the ecosystem is, and in some ways, how small. For what's one of the last big wild ecosystems in the temperate zones, I can still drive to the other end of it in about 4 or 5 hours and hike up to the highest point in another 5-6 hours. It's wild and remote country, and it's rugged, but it's also getting constricted by development. I've really noticed changes over the years since I started exploring this ecosystem, with more people everywhere and more roads, and that's pretty disturbing. But I also noticed still how spectacular this place is, and how you can get on top of a peak and look all around you and hardly see any sign of people, and listen and just hear the sounds of nature and the wind and birds, and really get a chance to tune out the human commotion for a little while. And that's another reason I do it.
What do you hope for the ecosystem in the future? What do we need to do?
For the Greater Yellowstone, it's a tough one. A lot of different things we need to do. Some of them won't ever happen, but we need to take a serious look at the development footprint that has already occurred throughout Greater Yellowstone, and maybe think about limiting that. You look at places like Big Sky and Yellowstone Club that just are absolutely sprawling at an unprecedented rate. Yeah, gigantic trophy homes on every ridge. I don't know how you do that. People don't like their rights infringed on, and they think of private property as an inherent right. And, how do you zone it? How do you limit development footprints? I mean, I live in a 1,200-square-foot house on a tiny urban lot, and that's enough for me. I don't know why people need a 20,000-square-foot trophy mansion as their third home on a ridge, on Andesite Mountain. But they want it, and so they get it. You can sit up on that in your trophy home and think how you've got it made, but what have you just done to the land? So I don't know. In general, I want to see as much of the wild land preserved as possible, and I want to see people treat the land with respect. I want to see the wildlife thrive and continue to be here. I want people to have a good life here and respect each other and each other's enjoyment of the land without just thinking I have a right to do anything everywhere. So yeah, Greater Yellowstone's pretty unique. If we don't really keep an eye on what's going on here and each do our part, we're going to lose it. So roads are the biggest impact people can have on the land, other than building cities and towns on it. You know, you put roads in, it really changes a place and fragments the habitat. So we need to keep all roadless areas roadless from here on out.
Let's touch on one other topic and then we can wrap it up. So everyone's talking about recreation now, and I'm seeing it all over the West. I know I'm not the only one. It's been intense, and there's trash and people and feces, and you know, it gets back to freedoms and public lands and responsibility. But I don't know what to do about this. It's pretty crazy, and I'm seeing places that I've never seen people before. Just in the last couple of years, and there's trees cut down everywhere and trash everywhere, and it's really disheartening.
Yeah.
What do you see going on out there?
Well, same thing you're seeing, more people everywhere, and it's partly a result of COVID, where a lot of people's traditional outlets are not available. They don't want to go into gyms. You know, their organized sports aren't happening, so they're going to the trails and nature, and a lot of people don't have a lot of experience out there, or if they do, you know, there's just more of us in general. So I think we're seeing more and more folks go out that don't really respect the land. They're escaping to someplace. Let me put it this way. They're escaping from rather than to. And so the place they go is just to get away from the city. They're bringing some of their city habits with them, you know, leaving trash or, like you say, cutting down trees. They think they can just do what they want once they're out there. It's a real problem. You know, dispersed camping is going on everywhere. Some people call it boondocking, just camping wherever the heck you want. And in a lot of national forest areas, that's legal. In others, it's not. One problem you have is, you know, public land agencies that are hamstrung. They can't get out there and patrol near enough. When was the last time you saw a forest ranger out in the forest checking on what people are doing, whether they're leaving their campfires unattended, whether they're, you know, leaving their feces out there in the woods, not burying stuff? Yeah, it's mind-blowing. I don't entirely understand the phenomenon, but it's an escape from the cities where people want elbow room, and so they go wherever they can where there's fewer people. Other than that, they're not really thinking about what they're doing. I mean, my wife and I went to Cliff Lake for an overnight canoe trip. There was all our usual campsites on the backcountry were taken, which is fine. We found a good site. Then I go to the best tent site I could find. There's a huge pile somebody had left there of their own waste with one rock put on top of it. Now, I had to move that before I could set up our tent and clean that up. You know, it's just foul. It's like, what are you doing out there, people? Whatever happened to leave no trace? So, yeah, it's frustrating.
Yeah, there's no easy answers. We just got to keep talking about it, I guess.
Right.
That's a good point. People leave in the cities. They're used to all the services being right there.
Yep.
You know, they flush the toilet. They have a trash can to throw their trash in.
Right.
They have heat so they can... I mean, everyone wants to start a campfire, but let's say they're cold and they didn't... They can't turn on the thermostat, so they have to go collect wood that they didn't plan to bring with them.
Yeah.
So it's just this cascading effect. And
yeah, and all the campgrounds are full every night, and so people spread out from there to wherever they can end up. I mean, on my drives to and from Yellowstone, I often drive early in the morning when it's dark. Every pullout along the highways has a camper or two in it. Places it's, you know, they're not supposed to be camping there, but they have nowhere else to go, and they end up not planning, or they think they can just get a campsite somewhere. There's nothing available, so they just camp wherever. They're doing it in Yellowstone, too. The park was forced to open campgrounds they weren't planning to open because people were just boondocking everywhere. At least in the campgrounds, they can control it, you know. But then there's still people everywhere, so it's crazy. And, you know, a lot of people are going out with their big, expensive toys, too. This isn't all just like hippies with tents. These are people with giant trailers full of ATVs and side-by-sides, and they bring the entire family out, and they have this huge get-together with all these expensive toys and, you know, big pickup trucks, and it's like a Trump rally in the woods, and they're building a huge fire, and they're loud, and you know, I guess they have a right to be out there too, but their impact is a lot higher with all these high impact toys they're bringing out there. Fly around the campground in their four wheeler and, you know, tear up every trail. So it's crazy out there.
I've never seen so many ATVs and side by sides.
No.
Out ever. And it's crazy. I mean, the industry is loving it. They're selling them left and right. They can't keep them in stock. The RVs are flying off the lots.
Yeah, I don't know where people are getting the money if everybody's out of work, you know?
Yeah, just throw it on the credit card.
I guess that's what it is.
What's another loan on top of debt?
Worry about it later.
Worry about it later. The American way.
Yeah, you bet. So one more thing I wanted to mention, and that is the dilemma of mountain biking. And we haven't brought that up, and that's become a pretty high-impact activity, too. And they're having an inordinate, the mountain biking community is kind of having an inordinate influence on public lands. And I think they really need to, I'm a mountain biker, we need to self-examine what are we doing. Because mountain biking is starting to be used as a tool, as a club, by the pro-development forces to stop any kind of wilderness designation or recommended wilderness. And I think that's shameful. Custer Gallatin National Forest Plan, mountain bikers got almost everything they wanted in that, as opposed to people that would like recommended wilderness. We got very little. And, you know, what are you guys doing? It's like, okay, this is a fun sport, but we shouldn't be all doing it everywhere at once. We should put some limits.
Let's make that connection again. So mountain bikers and the extraction industry are unlikely bedfellows when you first think about it. But when you have a wild landscape or a roadless land, which are places that mountain bikers would like to go, what happens if that recommended wilderness is not recommended for these areas that mountain bikers want so much?
Right.
What's the true risk there beyond just the impacts for mountain bikers and wildlife? What can happen to the trees in the ecosystem?
What you can get is an ever-increasing influx of mechanized recreationists. And it's the same thing that's going on that we were just talking about. Not all these mountain bikers are going to be ethical or care about their impact on the land. Some of them could care less. It's just a playground. They're going to build berms on the trails. They're going to cut down trees to widen the trails. I've seen it this summer. I've documented that very thing. They're going to build new trails where it's illegal to build trails. It's illegal to build any trail in a national forest without prior authorization. And yet they're doing it everywhere. And it's also, it allows, in some cases, motorized access to continue. So you have the double-edged sort of, you know, you got the double impact of mountain biking and motorcycles, just destroying trails and harassing wildlife.
And logging under forest health.
That could be allowed too, in some of these so-called backcountry areas.
Yeah.
Yep. It leaves it open to all that. It isn't just that, now the mountain bikers still get to use the trails they want. It leaves the place open to other impacts too.
It goes to show you how strong and important the Wilderness Act still is today, where that's avoided at all costs.
Right.
So that's very telling that the Forest Service wants to avoid it. Otherwise, they lose control at that point, right?
Right.
So they're an extraction mandated agency. Once it's given up to wilderness, they've lost management control.
Kind of true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still under their jurisdiction, but they can't do much beyond maintain trails and patrol it with some backcountry rangers, at least you hope. So, yeah. But I think if we need anything less of on the land, it's control. Let's let nature run wild a little bit, eh?
Here. Let nature do its thing. Let's get out of the way a little bit. And yeah, it's the best thing we can do at this point. It's such a wounded planet. Let's show some restraint and humility and back off a bit and let some natural processes give it their best shot.
There you go. Well, it's kind of doing that regardless of what we want. Don't let some of the smaller natural processes operate. The bigger ones are taking over. Fire, hurricanes, climate. Yeah, the party is just getting started.
Sure is. We need to be humbled, too. We really need to be humbled. Phil, thanks for your time. Thanks for your work. And it's a pleasure to have gotten to know you and work with you a bit. So thanks for everything that you do.
Yeah, definitely, Adam. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe through your podcasting app. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit wildernesspodcast.com/support. Thanks for listening.